This next case is A23-0042, in re the estate of Mark G. Anderson, deceased. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. We have a center podium. This is a live streamed argument, but we keep an audio version only for our, which will be posted on the court's website for posterity. We didn't get to get them in the courtroom, but we have some middle school students who are watching in another courtroom, the live stream, as part of a connection with our with the schools here. So FYI for counsel, we have some engaged students who are going to be watching this argument as well. And so counsel for appellant, when you're ready, go ahead, take the podium. And if I didn't say so, please both of you state the name and the party you represent for the record. Go ahead.
Morning, may it please the court. Al Cheetah, I'm the attorney for Mary Alberson, who is the personal representative of the estate of Mark Anderson. And just for the record, Ms. Alberson is the decedent's sister, and she was duly named as the alternate personal representative under the will that's in dispute here. But she's also statutorily entitled to priority with or without the will. She was appointed. She's filed a bond. We're here today. As you know, we tried the case and the missing will. There's no question but that the original was delivered to the decedent and that it can't be found. That triggers the common law presumption of revocation. And the common law presumption, the cases discussing it are most pertinent cases are appropriate cases are Botko, Punt, and Langley. Langley points out that the common law presumption is that it's missing because it was destroyed. We believe that the trial court made errors of fact, which you review on a clearly erroneous standard, and errors of law, and which is a de novo review, and also she made errors in applying the facts to the law, which you review de novo as well. What are the errors? Well, the errors are the first one, the most egregious one, was a finding that Ms. Alberson, on the way home, I think you probably have read my brief, the primary beneficiary under the will was the decedent's son, Jeffrey. And Jeffrey was a troubled child, to put it mildly. His death certificate is on file with my brief. It shows that he died of methamphetamines. He had a lot of problems. On March 15th of 2015, the decedent with his sister, the personal representative, Mary Alberson, discovered that his son had stolen $71,000 from his account at the credit union. He was.
I want you to continue, but just to focus this, are you, you've talked about legal errors by the district court that you're asserting, as well as errors of factual findings. Are you in the factual finding realm right now?
I'm just giving you background, Your Honor.
Okay.
The factual error is this. During the trial, Ms. Alberson testified that on the way home, she was driving her brother back to the assisted living facility. This was prior to his having a conservatorship appointed. He was always competent. There was never guardianship. The decedent said to her, "I'm going to change my will." The trial court has an explicit finding that says, "I have revoked my will," which was ludicrous. How would he have known to revoke it that day? He just discovered that his son had stolen $71,000 and sold $100,000 of family jewelry. He had no reason to have revoked the will. She didn't say that. Her language is clearly set forth in the transcript. The trial court also made the clearly erroneous determination that she quoted her brother as having said, "I'm going to disinherit my son." She said no such thing. The trial court was clearly erroneous in its finding when it quoted the personal representative as having said, "I have revoked my will and I'm going to disinherit my son." She said no such thing. It's very egregious to me as an attorney that the court then used that language, which is nowhere in the transcript, used it to poison Ms. Alverson's credibility. She subsequently testified that after the death of her nephew, Jeffrey, the decedent's son, shortly after the funeral, she talked to her brother and he commented, "I destroyed that will." Now, the will, again, it does two things. It says everything to my descendants, which would have been his son, and if he's not around, then to the Boys and Girls Club of Duluth. The descendant had a relationship with the Boys and Girls Club. It had terminated.
Can I just step back again? So what we have is there's a missing will.
Yep.
Okay. Well, first of all, what we have is a contest to the will, right? The will was admitted. So your client has the ultimate burden of persuasion on invalidating the will.
That is correct.
In the meantime, we have a missing will.
Yep.
And that put the obligation on I guess
the proponent
to establish a prima facie case that there was a will. And then it's your client has to show, you know, rebut that with a prima facie case. And then your client has the ultimate burden. Where's the mistake that happened? I mean, there's a prima facie case, is there not, that the will exists and that it is a valid will?
The legal mistake, there are about three of them, maybe four of them. First of all, there is no prima facie evidence. The case law, Langley in particular, requires that the proponent of the missing will establish prima facie evidence, non-revocation. We've got 5 weak points that have nothing to do with the will. You have to have prima facie evidence. Looked it up in Black's Law Dictionary last night. It's evidence on its face. They talk about a transfer on death deed not being revoked. There were two of them, one for the decedent's home, one for the decedent's mother's house. It clearly was revoked prior to the death of the son. And there's a court order confirming that revocation. The other one was for the decedent's own homestead. It was clearly revoked, but that has nothing to do with revocation of the will.
Well, I think what there was there not testimony from, lawyers, testimony, or state lawyers, testimony from the conservator about the existence of the will, that there was never any request to change the will. They had a couple letters saying, "We've discussed with Mr. Anderson, no desire to change the will." There's the idea that while he still owned the property, there was never a revocation of the Todd's. You know, why is that not a prima facie case that the will was never revoked? I mean, what more does one need? You don't have the will. You have people testifying about the will and the decedent's desire not to change it. Why would that not be enough?
Well, first thing it does, Your Honor, is it shifts the burden. There is no obligation to consult with the bank about the will, and there's no obligation to consult with the attorney about the will. But they have flipped, or there's a subtle imposition.
I mean, isn't it just they're making an inference based on the testimony? If you have someone who says, "We would talk about the will. I'm his estate planner. I'm the conservator. I'm the attorney. He never told me anything about that," right? That he wanted to change it. Is it unfair for the district court to then infer from that that he didn't intend the actual intent? Is that really shifting the burden?
Yes, I think it is unfair, Your Honor, because it adds a new requirement that's found nowhere in the case law.
I mean, isn't it just reasoning that the district court is saying if he had intended to change the will, he would have expressed that intent. And because he didn't, that's an indication that he didn't intend to do that. Is that really shifting the burden, or is it evidence that he didn't intend to do it?
I think it changes the burden. I think it increases the burden. And there's something peculiarly unique in this case. The attorney in question, Stephen Overham, who testified that he had not been in touch really with the decedent much at all in the prior 10 years prior to his death. The attorney, Mr. Overham, was a 40-year member of the Objectors Board of Directors and a past president of the Boys and Girls Club. Isn't it more likely that the decedent didn't want to talk to him because he knew he'd be pressured? There is no case law or statutory requirement that as a precondition to revoking your will, you consult with counsel or your bank.
What do you think of prime? Oh, go ahead, Judge Jackson, sorry.
If I could just take you back, counsel, to the earlier discussion about the district court's credibility finding. So,
I'm very sorry. I'm an old broken down flight instructor who's now very hard of hearing.
I will speak up.
Thank you.
And more clearly. Okay. If I could take you back to the discussion about the district court's credibility finding regarding a client, because if we believe that there's no, assuming for purposes of this question, there was no clear error in finding that a prima facie case existed. So the burden shifts to your client, right? And the reason the district court believed your client hadn't met that burden was based on its credibility finding, correct?
I think it's intertwined with the purported failure to consult with counsel, the decedent's failure to consult with counsel, and the other five things, all of which were clearly erroneous. There's a finding that he didn't consult with counsel, for instance, about revoking the transfer on death deeds. That's irrelevant because they, in fact, were revoked, as shown by the court orders attached to my brief. But the sales were confirmed, thus revoking. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I thought the primary way your client was trying to demonstrate that he revoked the will was based upon her testimony, which the district court did not credit.
I see. I get that subtlety. Okay. I think that the fact that the will is missing leads to the presumption, shifts the burden, and I don't think they had prima facie evidence. I think they made arguments, and I think the personal representative's testimony, which is uncontradicted that about what he said, I think that is... that preponderates over their arguments as to the five things.
Well, whether we look at the credibility assessment in terms of the prima facie case or if it was made shifting the burden, either way, you talked about the district court's errors, factual errors that was based upon. Could you address how the district court rejected your arguments in your motion for amended findings, right? These arguments you're making to us.
It was like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. There was sort of a tacit admission that, yeah, she hadn't said that, but she had said revoke under cross-examination and trial. So therefore she used the word revoke, but she's still clearly erroneous in her initial finding that she said, I have revoked the will. She said, no such thing. And I'm going to disinherit Jeff. She said, no such thing. Frankly, I'm not quite sure how the court misread the record. I quoted the transcript as I have to you. You can't fabricate testimony and then use it to poison credibility.
Okay. But the district court in its motion, denying your motion to amend the findings, says it acknowledged that your client never used the word revoked, but still said that her testimony overall was that her belief was the will had been destroyed or revoked, and then doesn't amend its credibility finding. Don't we still have to give that credibility finding deference when they acknowledge, well, yes, the words were never exactly used?
You do give it deference, and yet, if you've got the firm and definite conviction that a mistake is made, you can overturn her.
Well, are you saying understand your argument. Are you saying that there was an error in the credibility finding itself, or are you saying instead that there was clear error in the facts that were then used to discredit or to call into question the credibility of the witness?
Both.
Okay, so what is the standard of review, if it's reviewable at all, for credibility?
I think the standard review on credibility is Abuse of discretion.
Don't we usually say we don't review credibility determinations?
Say that.
Doesn't our court usually say that we just don't review the credibility determinations? We defer to them?
That's true.
It seems like your argument really is about the findings underlying that determination of credibility. And you're saying because those five things are clearly erroneous, and that's what the district court used, in your words, to poison the credibility. So if we agree with you or don't agree with you on those five findings, sure, we think there was no clear error. Is there some separate argument you'd like to make now about why, if there was no error in those findings, there was some other error in her credibility determination?
Well, the credibility was one part of it, but there was the threshold imposition of a duty to consult with.
No, I understand there's maybe a legal argument separate from that. I'm just trying to get at the credibility challenge here.
If
we decide there was no clear error in those five findings, it seems based on what you've said that you would have to concede we would defer to that credibility determination. Or is there some other basis apart from the five factual findings that you're saying is clearly erroneous that poison credibility? Is there some other basis for us to review that credibility determination apart from the findings?
I think I'm stuck with the credibility determination. I'd simply say in the end, though, as I alluded to in my brief, there was not an overall credibility determination. There was, in the initial order, there was a determination that her testimony was not credible as to her story had shifted. There is no finding of an overall lack of credibility. I think it was a very specific finding. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you for traveling to Duluth for this hearing. May it please the court, my name is J. Steve Nyes, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the respondents, the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Northland, and the Paul Staudenmeyer Boys and Girls Club of Duluth Foundation. For ease of reference, I'll refer to both respondents simply as the Boys and Girls Club. And I may refer to the decedent, Mark G. Anderson, simply as Mark. A couple of procedural matters first, Your Honors, if you don't mind. Appellant has asked that our respondent's brief be disregarded because it was initially mailed to an incorrect address. What appellant, of course, ignores is that appellant missed her initial filing deadline for this appeal and had to be given extra time by the court in order to submit her brief. She also ignores the fact that her attorney asked me if we would accept service of appellant's brief by email, and I politely agreed to do that. Furthermore, we had emailed our respondent's brief to appellant's attorney the same day it was filed and the same day it was mailed. And I believe that same day or maybe a day later, appellant's attorney acknowledged receipt. So although we sincerely apologize for the unfortunate and unintentional mistake with the physical mailing address, appellant received our brief immediately after it was filed, and appellant has not been disadvantaged in any way as a result. For that matter, Your Honors, we must point out that the appellant has been given multiple bites at the apple throughout these proceedings. For example, appellant's post-trial motion for amended findings and or a new trial fatally omitted any basis for the motion being made, but the trial court still considered the motion anyway. If anyone has been disadvantaged during this proceeding by the actions of the other party, it's the Boys and Girls Club. Now, as far as that reply brief that was submitted, Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 128.02 Subdivision 3 requires a reply brief to be confined to new matters raised in the respondent's brief. And reading that reply brief, it seems to us that most, if not all, of the substantive matters raised are merely rehashed arguments from their first brief, or maybe expansions upon them. So we would ask the court to disregard those parts of the reply as the court sees fit. Okay, so I'll shift now to the law being applied and the legal standard of review. Appellant argues in her brief, and you heard Mr. Cheetah argue here today, that the interpretation of a statute is an issue of law which is reviewed de novo, and that is correct, but the trial court's decision is not based on an interpretation of a statute. It's based on the interpretation of some case law. Now, the trial court's legal reasoning was based on this precedential case called the Estate of Langley, which is cited many times both in appellant's brief and in respondent's brief. And as we've heard some discussion about already, the Langley case basically calls for the weighing of evidence for and against the alleged revocation of a decedent's lost will and determining what is more likely. In the present case, the estate of Mark Anderson, the trial court weighed all of the evidence presented by both parties at trial and correctly found that it was more likely the decedent did not revoke his will. Now, of course, it's a little more complicated than that. So let's talk about where the appellant really gets bogged down in our arguments, specifically this presumption of revocation of a lost will. According to the Langley case, if a will is lost, it shifts the burden to the proponent of the will to produce evidence of non-revocation. Once evidence is produced by the proponent of the will that, on its face, suffices to prove the will was not revoked, the will should be admitted to probate, unless the proponent's evidence does not preponderate over the evidence offered by the contestant. And importantly, as you have noted, the contestant has the ultimate burden of persuasion on revocation. The preponderance of the evidence standard requires that to establish a fact, it must be more probable that the fact
is. So, I'm going to interrupt because I think you're going to run out of time here a little bit. I wanted to hear your direct response to the questions that I was asking regarding the credibility determination, and I'll flip it for you. If we agree that there was clear error in the fact findings, it does seem to me that that played a role in the district court's credibility determination. Would you concede that if we agreed there was clear error in those five factual findings that we would be left with having to I don't want to say reverse or but we would be our opinion would have to set aside that credibility determination?
I have a couple of responses to that. I think first of all, one, if there was any misunderstanding by the trial court, it's understandable given the appellant's clearly conflicting testimony throughout the trial. She had her story straight on direct examination, but upon cross-examination and at the end of the hearing, upon examination by Judge Tarnowski herself, she struggled to explain what was really going on and didn't have good answers. Now, even if there was some sort of mistake made, and I'm not saying there was, regarding certain parts of the appellant's testimony as set forth in the order probating the will or the order denying the motion for new trial, there's still a mountain of other evidence out there that Mark Anderson did not revoke his will.
Again, so let's assume we disagree and assume we conclude that it was clear error. What do we do with the credibility finding given our typical standard of review for credibility as we defer?
Well, I would expect that you would send it back for further testimony.
All right. And I didn't mean to cut you off either when I initially jumped in or the second time I interrupted you when you were going to tell me why this other evidence supports the fact findings and there is no clear error.
Sure. And I'm going to get to that in just 1 second. But first, I do want to note that as far as the law goes, appellant relies on the exact same case law in her brief that we rely on in ours. The difference being the appellant ignores crucial components at the beginning and the end. Particularly, appellant doesn't really even acknowledge the part of the rule from the Langley case regarding the preponderance of the evidence standard. And she seems to be kind of ignoring the part about actually having a burden of her own, the burden to prove a revocation, the burden that she failed to meet. I also, regarding the Langley case, the facts in Langley are strikingly similar to the facts in our present case. Gus Langley had a will and a codicil. He was represented by an attorney. He repeatedly confirmed that he wanted to keep his will and codicil in place. After he died, the original will and codicil could not be found, but significant circumstantial evidence confirmed the finding of non-revocation of Gus Langley's will. So what's really happening here is just that the appellant doesn't like the trial court's findings based on all the evidence that was presented. So let's talk about that evidence. The facts presented by the respondent at trial were established and supported by the testimony of multiple disinterested witnesses and multiple pieces of physical evidence, And those facts are set forth in chronological order in our brief, so I'm not going to recite them all today, but I do ask the court to consider some important highlights as follows. One, the decedent, Mark Anderson, or simply Mark, was represented by a highly competent estate planning attorney, Mr. Steve Overham, and others under Mr. Overham's direction for the last 20 years of Mark Anderson's life. Two, Mark had an established history of working with his estate planning attorney to solve his estate planning, quote, problems, unquote, revoking documents, drafting documents, reviewing his estate plan, and seeking the appointment of a conservator over his estate. Three, Mark never told his attorneys or his court-appointed conservator that he wanted to revoke or change his will. In fact, the opposite. When presented with an opportunity to change his will by his attorney, Mark chose not to make any changes. Appellant is attempting to make the argument that the decedent was not required to consult his attorney or required to consult his conservator about changing his estate plan. Okay, fine. He wasn't required to do that, but he did it anyway. Four, the appellant, Mary Alverson, never said anything to Mark's attorneys or conservator about Mark allegedly telling her he wanted to change his will, or about Mark allegedly telling her he had revoked or destroyed his will, either during Mark's life or after Mark died, including never telling attorney Steve Overham, Mark's attorney for many years, about this alleged revocation when she spoke to Mr. Overham about probating Mark's estate. Then what happened? She changes horses midstream and talks to Mr. Cheetah and asks him to prepare a probate petition to determine Mark died intestate. And five, Mark had a long relationship with the Boys and Girls Club, and while serving as the club's president, was directly involved with establishing what eventually became the Paul Staudenmeier Boys and Girls Club of Duluth Foundation, which he ultimately named as the residuary devisee under his will. Appellant also tries to make a big deal about it being many years since Mark was directly involved with the club. So let's think about that. Mark's direct involvement with the club ended in 1998. 12 years later, in 2010, he names the foundation as the ultimate residuary devisee under his will. And then, 7 years after that, he confirms to his attorney, and not Steve Overham, but someone working under Steve Overham's direction, that he did not want to change his will naming the foundation as a devisee, nearly 20 years later. So with my last few minutes here, I'd like to address just a couple more items. Once again, and I can't stress this enough, the trial court found appellant's testimony not to be credible, not just with regard to specific statements, but in general. The court's statements as to the appellant's credibility can be found both in the trial court's initial order and in the order denying the motion for the amended findings and or new
trial. What's the best statement from either order to support that it was a general finding on credibility, or determination, I should say, on credibility?
In multiple places in the second order, I believe the finding is the trial court did not find the personal representative's testimony credible, period. It's not enough for the appellant to argue that there's only this presumption of revocation when an original will cannot be found, and then to try to discredit all of the evidence offered by the proponent of the will. The appellant actually had to provide evidence of her own that supports her claim of revocation, and she failed to provide any of that evidence beyond her own self-serving testimony, which again was found not to be credible. Appellant also talks a lot about how much of the evidence presented by the respondent is not relevant. Well, the time to argue about relevance was during the trial. I don't believe there are any arguments in appellant's brief that the evidence was admitted over her attorney's objection as to relevance at trial. Furthermore, all evidence is relevant if it has any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. So all of the appellant's arguments about relevance utterly fail. Appellant also makes a number of arguments or statements about not needing to prove the decedent wanted to disinherit his son. Well, she clearly attempted to do just that circumstantially with copious testimony and exhibits at trial regarding the decedent's son, Jeff, and why the decedent wouldn't want his son to inherit his estate. Now, our response throughout these proceedings is that those pieces of evidence offered by the appellant just don't make any sense. While Jeff was alive, if Mark had revoked his will, Jeff still would have inherited Mark's estate. After Jeff died, there'd be no reason to revoke the will because nothing could then go to Jeff. So, for the reasons set forth in our brief, and I know I've got a minute left if there are any other questions, and based on the entirety of the trial court record, we ask that the trial court's order admitting the copy of Mark Anderson's will to probate be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Again, may it please the court, the red herring surfaces again. There never was a claim by Ms. Alverson that there was an expressed intention to disinherit Jeff.
Can I ask this, counsel? I mean, Ms. Alverson is arguing that the will was revoked.
Yes.
She introduced herself, her own evidence of a conversation with Jeff. She put all of that into, a conversation related to Jeff, right?
With Mark, the decedent.
Right, with Mark about Jeff. She offered that evidence about that conversation, et cetera.
Yes.
What was the point of offering that evidence about that conversation?
Background for the court. He said he was going to change his will. That could have been anything from a revocation to a... putting some strings on the inheritance. There's no question that the decedent loved his troubled son, Jeff, and did not disinherit him. Did not, absolutely did not disinherit him. He hoped against hope that Jeff would straighten out, but he died of a drug overdose.
So when you say didn't disinherit him, she does argue that the will was revoked. But
that would have been one of the ways. There were four components to the estate plan: the will, the IRA beneficiary designation, and the two transfer on death deeds.
Right. But her desire, presumably in offering that evidence about that conversation, was to prove her argument that the will was revoked, right?
Yes.
I mean, so that's, you know, in the district court, in the second order, went through the arguments that you're making, I think, today about what the precise testimony was about that conversation, et cetera. But at the end of the day, on page 7, said, the court continues to find the personal representative's testimony regarding the descendant's will to be not credible.
All right.
And that seems like a pretty broad statement about her argument, recognizing what you're saying about the precise wording. I'm just thinking, you offered that information presumably to show a revocation, and the court's saying, I don't accept it.
You are correct. Now, let's do this. Let's assume that there was no testimony whatsoever by Ms. Alverson in that instance. We still don't have any prima facie evidence.
Right, but you just said something that I want to make sure I understand. Because you kind of made a face. I saw you mouth the word no when opposing counsel was saying that there was a general finding of credibility. So it sounds like you just agreed to that, because the portion of the order that I think Judge Smith was quoting from on page 7, paragraph 33, is exactly the place, exactly the citation that respondents give in their brief for that conclusion. And it does say testimony regarding the descendant's will. So that is what is not credible. Anything regarding the will seems pretty general. So are you now agreeing, despite your reaction, are you now agreeing that this is a general credibility determination?
I still respectfully disagree that it's a general determination. It's predicated on the specific comments in the car ride and what he supposedly said. And you know, it's sort of an after the fact. I'm reluctant to concede that it's a general determination for reasons the court would certainly understand. But if we were to totally deny that testimony, or it never happened, where is the prima facie evidence regarding the will? We've got two transfer on death deeds that were terminated. We've got a IRA beneficiary designation, and we got two court orders that basically put the lie to the bank's letter to Mary Alverson, which was not copied to the decedent, saying how much he loved his estate plan and wasn't going to change it. And then we've got the law firm's letter to the bank, not to the decedent, not copied to the decedent. Where is the prima facie evidence? Even without Mary Alverson's testimony, Mary Alverson's testimony, Your Honor, in the end was offered as an attempt to rebut, to the preponderate requirement. We don't think they had prima facie evidence. They disagreed. They had the five factors. We don't think they were prima facie, and we still think that her testimony is uncontradicted, albeit purportedly not credible, but you only get to that lack of credibility by first misquoting her, and that is clearly erroneous. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case is, thanks for your briefing and your oral arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.